Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by the media entrepreneur Laura Desmond. Laura spent 8 years at Starcom MediaVest, a media agency part of Publicis Group, the third largest communication group in the world. As one of the youngest CEOs to lead a global marketing services company, Laura doubled the size of the business and worked with brands including Samsung and Coca-Cola. She is now a board member of Adobe Systems, senior advisor at Uptake, a predictive analytics company, and also director of Vibes, a mobile marketing firm. Laura, thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Paul.
Well, Laura, that's an incredibly impressive career so far. How did you get started and what did you want to be at the beginning of your career? How ambitious were you?
Well, I think looking back, I was probably fairly ambitious, but, you know, I think it's true of me when I started in advertising. It's true now. I really was just curious to learn and have new challenges and feel like I was taking on challenges and problems that hadn't been solved yet. So when I started as a media intern at the old Leo Burnett back in the day when it was full service, I was grateful to just be selected. I was one of 10 people hired that year in 1987. At the time, Leo Burnett was the world's largest advertising agency, probably the most respected one, top of its game. And it was widely known as a place where, kind of like Procter & Gamble was at one point in time and still is today, it was widely known as the place that if you really wanted to learn advertising and you really wanted to have a great training program and work with some of the best talent in the industry and some of the best clients, you would work at Leo Burnett. So I was very fortunate to be hired. And from there, it was just about learn as much as I could, spend as much time with smart people as I could, work with great clients and go from there.
And when you set out on your career, did you know you wanted to be in the creative sector? Was it advertising? Was it media? How did you envisage your career being?
It was more advertising. The way I fell in love with it was I was in a rhetoric class my freshman year in college, and we were given an assignment to pick advertising out of a old magazine then and argue for was advertising of that particular brand good or bad for society. I picked Crest toothpaste, which is one of the largest P&G brands, which ironically ended up being one of our largest clients for the many years I was at SMG. And of the 20 kids in the class, I was the only person to argue that advertising and Crest toothpaste as a brand was positive for society. And my argument had to do with the fact that if there wasn't for brands and marketing and P&G, there wouldn't be the discovery of fluoride. And if there wasn't fluoride, there wouldn't be modern toothpaste. And if there wasn't modern toothpaste, well, our teeth would all be falling out. I took that position, and I was the only one of 20 to take a positive position. All 19 folks said, nah, advertising's crap and it's ruining the world. So I figured after that assignment, maybe that was a sign. So I just started to learn more and go from there. And I ended up getting a business degree in marketing with also a subject matter intensive in philosophy. So I figured I knew how to market and I knew how to think and argue. That led me to Leo Burnett.
So a career in advertising was always going to be the way.
Yes, and I loved it. And then 2 to 3 to 4 years in, you could begin to see there was a big shift between where the world had been and how brands were marketing and where the world was going. So I started to really spend a lot more time in media, and I really loved it. And I loved the idea that it was fresh and new, and it was fragmenting very quickly, and it was specializing very quickly. And fast forward maybe 10, 12 years into my career, I had a choice. Was I going to stay with Leo Burnett and continue with advertising creativity, or was I going to follow a media path and actually be part of creating and building the media business at Leo Burnett, which first was Leo Burnett Media and then became Starcom? And I chose the media path. And I chose it because I thought there was just going to be a world of opportunity for me. I would learn more. I would be challenged more. And it was an area that was truly innovating at a rapid pace. And clients were really leaning in. And they were beginning to see that, you know, where you spent your money was as important, if not even more important, than what you said. And I wanted to be part of that. So towards the end of the 90s, we split off as Starcom. I went that route. I did some global media jobs with Coca-Cola and Kellogg, and then from there I was asked to build our media network, which then became Starcom Medievest Group in Latin America, and I spent 3 years doing that in the big eight countries of Latin America.
Wow, what was that like?
In many ways, tremendously fun, tremendously challenging in that you could argue that Latin America was the last region of the world to accept the unbundling of the advertising process. And so we really had to go in every market, every office, every leader of every agency, and really tell a story to convince them for why that agency leader who had been overseeing creative and media and production and full service work needed to carve out media and let Starcom run the business, not for him, but as a partner to him or her. So it was challenging. You really had to go in with a strong argument. You also had to earn those leaders' trust that, no, we're not going to screw it up and we're not going to ruin client relationships and we're going to take care of people and we're going to build a good business and we're going to be a true partner. And doing that in a second language, which was my first, English, was also a bit of a challenge. But the things that I learned in Latin America about building a business were you have to be entrepreneurial and you have to gain people's trust and you have to tell a tight, cohesive story. And you have to be able to take your craft and break it down and explain it so people who don't have subject matter expertise can understand. And those were really key early lessons for me that I think helped me prepare for bigger and bigger leadership and executive roles because, you know, the irony is the farther you get away from actually the doing of the work and the doing of the craft, the more simple and clear and focused a story you have to tell to convince people who've never worked in that area before. So it was great foundational learning for me. I also learned to do a lot with a little, and that was a region that did not have a ton of resources like a Europe or a North America. And I learned make your own luck. And that's a very important cultural concept in amongst Latins. It's this idea that luck isn't given to you and luck isn't bestowed on you. You make your own luck with hard work and with focus. And if you do all those things, then luck will find you. And I learned that's a really great concept.
It sounds as you've moved through your career, though, that you've not only learned a lot about honing your craft, but learned a lot about yourself. Did you discover a kind of entrepreneurial gene at this point?
Looking back on it, I think that's a really insightful comment.
Because clearly your behavior is very entrepreneurial.
I've always wanted to try to be that way. And, you know, growing up, I had these dreams of owning my own business and having my name, you know, above the door or on the door. And I have no regrets that that hasn't happened, or at least I didn't do that right out of college or in my 20s or 30s. I think, you know, if I were graduating today, I'd probably take a very different approach because the era of the founder and the era of the entrepreneur is a very different thing now.
It's such a different climate now, isn't it?
It is. And so in some ways, and you've mentioned uptake, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure. In some ways, being in that environment is really feeling, going back to my roots, going back to a place that always felt very natural to me, which is treat the business like it is literally out of your garage. Treat the business with a lot of care. Be good to people. Set people on a mission that they feel good about. Try to do some good in the world. It's not all take. It's also give. And then I think also this sense of move with clarity, move with purpose, move fast. I think one of the things that I saw working with big Fortune 100 clients and also with, you know, our own company at SMG and Publicis is the larger you get, you have the power and the lever of scale. And that's a really powerful thing. But you have to keep speed and going and the ability to go fast as a weapon, too. I remember Sheryl Sandberg once said to me, fast beats slow and fast beats big. And I think she's right. And so as I look at Google and Facebook and other Silicon Valley companies, they are just absolutely possessed and obsessed with keeping speed. And I think one of my natural instincts when I ran SMG and working with clients was to try to use speed, to try to use decisiveness as a key tool even with being a big company in scale too.
Because there is a problem, isn't there, when you have a huge behemoth global companies that they actually just lack the agility. There's so many different systems and administrative bureaucracies that they have to jump through that getting something done quickly is a challenge in itself.
There is a system piece to it. You know, so many companies grow up with, you know, legacy systems, legacy decisions, legacy processes they don't even know that they have. And then you layer on top of that maybe lots of layers and lots of levels of decision making and approvals and such and such. And before you know it, you know, you're operating at a different pace and different speed than that 100-person company or even that 500-person company. There's nothing inherently bad about that. And I really want to make that point. Big things like aircraft carriers, 747s, have to move at their rate of speed. There is great advantage to size and to scale. But I think in this world, it's and. It's not we're just big, or it's not we're just fast. It's how can you combine scale and speed? That's something that I think Google and Facebook and the global platform companies have set a new standard for all of us to follow. You know, it's a challenge, and sometimes it can be, I think, really frustrating. But truthfully, you know, the marketplace of ideas, the marketplace in general, doesn't care. It's indifferent. Are you adding value? Are you creating value? Are you doing what people want, what consumers want, what clients want? And now it's a size and scale game plus speed.
Because it is difficult, isn't it, to be customer-centric when you are such a huge company, because you are so far away from the consumer's thoughts. You almost have to have processes in itself just to stay connected to your customers and your clients.
You know, I suppose so. You know, I think that was, for my leadership at SMG, we really tried to keep people at the center, consumers at the center of everything we did. I think that for any agency in the marketing services sector, knowing people, what drives them, their behaviors, insights about them, their attitudes, their approaches, the differences between what they do and what they think and what they believe, all of those insights and that compelling consumer knowledge is really one of the most important differentiators of a marketing service agency business, whether it be media, whether it be creative data. And putting people at the center and really being able to connect and channel consumers' thoughts and consumers' needs and unmet needs is the secret sauce of marketing. And so I think one of the things that has to happen every once in a while for everybody is, okay, we're in business and we're serving clients, but we have to always remember we're in the consumer business. And that means what's our proprietary knowledge? What's our research chops? How are we working to be able to put data together to get at, you know, the edge of insight that maybe our competition doesn't have? You always have to go back and ground yourself to that. I would argue that the media business is really closest to consumers at the center, even a bit more than just the creative agency business. The creative agency really has to think about brands. You know, the branding of an entity as much as they have to think about which consumers are going to buy it. Whereas a media agency has to really look at what are people doing? What are they watching? What are they viewing? What are they spending time with? And then how do I connect that to a brand so that I'm reaching them at the right place, right time? And that really requires a grounding in data and research, I think, at a whole new level. And certainly now with big data and analytics, it's, you know, leapfrogging ahead and changing the agency business before our eyes.
I'm interested in the dynamic of running a creative services business because, you know, you employ a team of creatives who are doing the work, but you're managing them. I've always thought, you know, if you're an architect, for example, you might want to design houses, but if you run an architecture practice, you're actually managing a team of architects that are doing the house designing. Did you ever want to be closer to the coalface in terms of the creative, or did you make time for that as well?
I definitely made time for it, and I definitely wanted our company and companies to be our clients' creative agency partners' best partner. And we felt strongly about that because whether a client wants to have a specialized creative partner and a specialized media partner, They wanted integration at the end of the day. They wanted both agencies to play good or play well in a sandbox. So we very much wanted to be the creative partner on the business, their best partner. The way we did that was being as strategic a partner as we could be. This may sound somewhat, simplistic, but what we found is that when you really befriended creatives, what they really want is they're hungry and they're thirsty for more ideas, more inspiration, more knowledge, more data. They don't care where it comes from. They're really, neutral about that, but they're selfish about, I want more ideas. And so we tried to look at our, the actual creatives working on a brand or a piece of business as places where we could test and almost hothouse our ideas. Some would be loved, some would be rejected. But what we found is that if we could be kind of like that innovator and hothouser of what ifs, we could earn a place at the creative strategy branding table. And then we could in turn invite our creative partners to the media table when we had to start to think about, connecting brands and consumers on what platforms, what channels, and in what context. And I actually think that's one of the power, the unspoken power of integration today is, okay, we all have the, these traditional themes of the right thing to say in the right place in the right time. But when you put those things together, it's really about context. And I think more than ever, context is really important to people now. They see so many different messages. They can block them. They can ignore them. They can swipe them away. They can click away. If you reach people with the right message at the right time in the right context, and I don't think it matters if it's as banal as I'm looking for bananas on Amazon, or I'm searching for a Beatles song on Alexa, or I'm spending time with a linear program, whether it be sports or events, if you can get people in the right context, they're going to pay more attention.
How do you do that?
That will help advertising.
Well, educate me then. How do you do that? Because that's a million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah. I think a lot of people have to start thinking about working off the same data sets, in all honesty. I think if you look at creative agency process, media agency process, PR process, promotional process, shopper marketing process, they all have their own process. And you could argue, well, integrate them. Okay, check. But they all have their own data sets. And if you can start to unify those data sets and have the creative agency working off the same data and analytics that the media agency is, that the research agency is, that the promotion, shop or marketing, et cetera, PR is, you'll get to common unified solutions that then can begin to broaden out this notion of context because people are looking at the same instrumentation of the brand and the media landscape. I think a lot of this just comes down to we're all looking at our own instruments. We all have a particular different bias or point of view about what we're seeing, about people, consumers, the brand, the media marketplace. And I think if we can bring all of that data together on more of a common platform, it will really solve a lot of the problems that we have. I think you see Publicis Group, my old agency, really working towards that with their Power of One integrated concept for clients. And then our tour's announcement this past week about an AI power platform that the entire holding company will be working off of. I think you see them making some really good attempts at working this through. And I think you'll start to see more clients say, hey, wait a second, in this era of technology stacks and big data and analytics, how are people looking at these data sets and are they using the same things to come to more unified, simple contextual answers for what's the best thing to say in the ad, what's the best place to put it, and what's the best time. So I think we're on our way. And I don't know if that will necessarily mean more integration in terms of more holding company business and less specialized business. But I do think that, we're entering an era of not just big data and analytics, but is everyone working off of the same data sets and same analytics in order to put these marketing programs together so that we're doing a little bit less siloed thinking and more unified solution thinking.
How do you engender a culture of that kind of tier one creativity, you know, being at the coalface when it is a big company? Because you've got more to lose. Real creativity is actually risky, isn't it?
It is. And I think, you know, culture is really at the heart of that. You know, do you reward risk taking? Do you celebrate the lonely man or lonely woman who actually has a big idea and goes for it? Do you try to cultivate a certain group of clients who actually want the crazy ideas and cultivate that kind of back and forth, fail forward thinking? There are some clients who are really risk adverse, and there are some clients who are like, bring it on, use me as your test case. So I think that, you know, overall, agencies that embrace innovation and have a culture of fail forward tend to just naturally do that better than agencies who are known for or cultivate more of a safer position, either with clients or with people. There's nothing good or bad about either one. I think a creative agency head will tell you risk-taking and innovation and edgy creativity has to be our DNA. I think, you know, someone from the media side may say, you know, we're playing with hundreds of millions of dollars and billions of dollars. We can't afford to screw it up for a client. Both are true. But, you know, you're also, if you're the creative guy, you're working with a brand reputation. Can't afford to screw that up. And if you're the media guy, the pace of change is just unrelenting. You can't afford to do yesterday's media plan either.
It's out of date, isn't it, already?
Pretty much, yeah.
How do you reconcile those two highly irreconcilable things? It reminds me of kind of quantum physics and, you know, large-scale Newtonian physics. But both are true, and yet they seem to contradict each other.
You know, honestly, that's the art of it all. I mean, it's not a science. That's the art of it all. And I think the best leaders and the best craftspeople, they have the ability to put the IQ and the EQ together, read a situation, understand what's at stake for a client or what's at stake for an agency. They know when to go for it. They know when to maybe pull it back a little bit. But that's the art of it all. And, you know, I used to say, you know, it's that simple, but it's that hard. And it is hard. I think running a modern service business in marketing today is a really, really tough challenge. They're hard jobs. They're a heavy
dose. I'm doing it. It's why I cry myself to sleep every night.
You know. I mean, it's, you know, off the charts EQ, off the charts IQ, off the charts technology quotient, off the charts quotient around running a business responsibly. You know, there's a lot of things that you're balancing.
And a lot of plates to spin.
Yeah, and, you know, and consumers are forcing you to spin even more because they're just way ahead of us all.
I'm a terrible host here because I've allowed you to go off on a very interesting tangent there. There's quite a few interesting things you've said there. But can I just bring it back to going through your career? Because I want to get through that before we go off and finish on the other topics. We got to where you were in South America and you were there for 3 or 4 years. What happened next?
So I was there for 3 years and I was asked by Jack Clues, who was the head of SMG at the time, if I'd be interested in moving to New York and run what was at the time MediaVest USA, based in New York. And MediaVest was a really strong company, unbelievable heritage, came out of the Darcy DMB&B networks. But it had hit a few bumps in the road at the time. This is 2003. So he asked me if I'd go and give that a shot. And I thought, what the hell? You know, be fun. It'll be New York. It'll be a big, meaty challenge. At that point in time, I'd spent a lot of time globally working in Latin America. I was ready to come back into North America. And I thought, okay, what the hell? I'm going into the unknown, and I'm going to this very, very strange country, otherwise known as New York, but I'll give it a shot.
We're here now.
And we're here
it
now.
Is the center of the world in many respects, isn't it?
It is, and especially the advertising world. But it's fun, actually, being here on 9th Avenue. I lived on the Upper West Side at 64 in West End, so I used to walk this way, because our offices are still at 52 in Broadway, so I used to walk down 9th Avenue quite a bit, so it's fun to see some of the old haunts.
So you moved to New York. Where were you in terms of your goals at this point? Did you said, you know, what the hell, but you must have had a to-do list.
I did. I went with the unshakable belief that whatever needed to be done, I would be able to do. And it was clearly a turnaround. in some ways, Medivest was stronger than my bosses thought it was or realized it was. It had an unbelievable base of talent, and it had an unbelievable source of goodwill from its longtime clients. And in some ways, it was a lot more broken, too. So I went into it and pretty quickly realized this is going to take a lot of energy, a lot of smarts, a lot of teamwork. I realized I was going to need to rethink and change the team quite a bit. But I also felt it was a tremendous opportunity to reinvent Medivest and in some ways take some of the ideas I had about how to create more of a modern media agency and really, you know, test that out and put it into practice and make it work.
Was it daunting in a good way? I mean, you doubled the size of the agency, didn't you?
I did. It's only daunting when you're in it. It's never daunting when you begin it, and it's never really daunting at the end. It's only daunting in the middle, but you're moving so quickly, you pretty much say, okay, I'm running for my life here, or we're moving really fast, and I don't know, we might be shit or we might be brilliant. Let's, you know, give it a go. And sometimes in those moments you catch yourself, you go, oh, man, I really hope this works, or man, I hope that presentation was great, or man, I hope this client, we screwed it up, and I hope this client gives us another chance. In those moments, you're really aware of you could succeed or fail. But in the whole arc of it, I guess the start and the finish is it doesn't feel that intimidating. But I don't think it can. I think, truthfully, if you feel intimidated at the beginning of something like that, you're only going to get more intimidated. I mean, that's just the truth. And so I think I was very lucky to have kind of a combination of a lot of confidence with a lot of trust in my own ability to adapt quickly and analyze, quickly determine what needed to be done, and get a group of people who would want to do it. It was just such a fun time, such a blast. Some of the people that came along on that ride, you know, we all think about it and talk about it as if it was just one hell of a good time.
Give us some of the highlights then. Come on, let's talk some good stuff.
Highlights. We went through an 18-month period of time where we had our three largest clients pitch their business. A couple did because it was just time. They hadn't done it for 10 years. One did it because they just weren't super happy. We won all three. It was the largest number of billings to be won in such a short period of time ever in North America, and it really put us on the map. Medivest was always known as a buying shop, much more from its heritage as being a big clout scale buyer for P&G and Mars and Kraft. And, you know, we just dared to say, you know what, we can be a great buyer, but we can be a great strategy company too. And we can be known for planning and insight and upstream work. We invested a lot in that area and we started winning a lot of planning assignments. I'll never forget my boss at the time said to me, the media planning for Mattel, which was an LA-based company, leader in you know, kids' toys, and we won the planning, and he said, I never would have believed that Medivest could ever even win a planning assignment. You know, that was kind of like a, huh, okay. But we did, and that was fun. Loved the challenge of that. We started a content business and really thought of content, I think, very innovatively for its time. Content was not the commercial breaks. Content was inside the program. Branded entertainment, interstitials, long form. We flipped to the digital channels very quickly. We did some of the earliest content work with Yahoo and AOL. We were some of the first to embrace content on YouTube, content with Facebook. Again, these were, you know, earlier days, pre-video, or pre-video on Facebook. And then we started our own digital unit inside the agency, which at the time was a pretty wild thing because this was when Digitas, AKQA, Razorfish, Avenue A, all of these digital shops existed as digital lighthouses for clients to go and use them instead of the big, fat, dumb, analog media agency. And we said, hey, we can be digital too. In fact, the power of analog and digital coming together and integrating that into a 360 approach is actually the better approach. And we made that argument to a lot of clients. We won a lot of digital business in a short period of time, too. So You know, we had a lot of fun. It was a great example of innovating at a high rate of speed, leveraging scale at a high rate of speed, a really great motivated group of people who believed in, you know, challenging convention, challenging what's possible, rewriting the playbook for what a media agency could do. And we had fun. And you know, to this day, the relationships and the bonds that I have with clients as well as the team are still really strong.
You were known then and even now as a passionate enthusiast for the digital side of the business.
Yeah, very much so. You know, I don't think I was particularly a great predictor or forecaster. You could just see where things were going. Things were becoming digitized incredibly quickly. And my belief was that, you know, consumers weren't going to be a different person watching TV than they were downloading a video than they were on their desktop. They were all the same person, so they would continue to consume against an array of channels, and they would want their brands to follow them as seamlessly. And so our thinking was, if we can be the guys to integrate, you know, be specialists in digital, but if we can give clients an integrated approach to think about analog targeting and digital targeting and placements and measurement and analytics all at the same time, we would really give our clients an advantage and we would help them with top line growth and more efficiency and effectiveness. So we tried we essentially powered on ourselves on the and strategy. And later on, as the global CEO of SMG, you know, I put a big goal out in front of our global team when I first took over being CEO. At the time, we were, you know, a company that was about 20% digital and 80% traditional media. And you could see where the trends were going. You could see people spending increasingly more time with digital than with analog. And so the goal I put out there was, let's try to be a company that has 50% of its source of business from digital content and analytics and 50% from traditional within 5 years. Now, when you're growing at about 10% per year, which we were, and you're starting from a point of 20 digital and 80 traditional, meeting that 50-50 number is a real big lift. And we did it. We actually did it in about 4 years, 3.5 to 4 years. And there were some countries like the U.S. that actually sourced about 65 to 70% of its revenues from digital content analytics. So they completely flipped. Other countries, especially the emerging markets like China and Eastern Europe and parts of Southeast Asia, India, they lagged because their digital media just wasn't at the same maturity level as analog media. So they lagged. They were more, you know, 60, 70% traditional, 30, 40% digital. But on a global basis, you know, we ended around 62-38 digital content analytics to 38% traditional. I was tremendously proud of us for that, that we took on a huge challenge to transform our business and to change how we did media, we thought about media, and we thought about connecting consumers to brands. And clients really, really respected it. They understood that we needed to follow consumers and we needed to go where they were spending their time. And they, you know, they helped us build capability around great digital expertise and then integrating that with the great analog expertise that we already had.
I mean, that is incredibly impressive. What was the biggest challenge in actually making it happen and, you know, bringing it to fruition?
Just getting people to believe it.
Internally and externally?
Yeah. And then secondly, having good research and capability to feed the decision making. And then in time with, you know, programmatic and, you know, big data analytics and tech stacks, in time you needed the investments in, you know, the hardcore infrastructure, DMPs, DSPs, in order to be able to activate data and activate that research in better and better ways. But at first it was belief, and then it became much more about having the tech stack and the big data analytics in order for us to do it at higher and higher levels at greater speed across a fragmenting marketplace, which you have now.
What came next career-wise?
Well, okay, so I went from MediaVest and I was promoted to SMG Americas, and that was a short-lived run for about a year. I was reporting to Renetta McCann, who was the CEO of SMG globally. And, you know, that was a, it was kind of returning to my roots of Latin America and continue to oversee North America. And then within a year, I was promoted to the global CEO of SMG. Did that for more than 8 years. Five of those, we were ranked as the number one global media planning and buying agency. We won Cannes Global Media Network of the Year. We were widely recognized as one of the most awarded agencies. I always wanted our company to be known for great strategy as well as great scale. So we paid a lot of attention to media as a craft of driving effectiveness, of driving growth, of driving ROI for our clients, as well as, you know, being able to, you know, execute great media buys and save our clients money too.
I mean, that must be an incredible array of responsibilities being operating at that global level.
Sometimes you just don't realize it or you don't think about it. You're just in the moment and you're just doing. I think that kind of in some ways, like, you know, children growing up, you don't recognize that they go from size 6X to 8 to 10 to 12, and all of a sudden, you know, they're bigger than you, they're taller than you, because you're living it and you're happening, and it's happening in real time in front of your eyes. I think looking back, you know, it was a great, big, daunting opportunity, and I was really, really thankful to have an amazing team to help share the burden and kind of offload some of the, you know, the responsibility in the right way. And, you know, very proud of the accomplishments, very proud of what we did. We did it as a team, and I think we set new standards for what we wanted a media agency to be. And it was a great, hell of a great ride. It was really fun.
How many other women were there in the senior clutch of roles globally at that point? Because was it still quite dominated by white 50, 60-year-old men?
Well, from the time of, I mean, my earliest days in my career, I usually was the only woman. I was usually the youngest person in the room, even as an executive.
So you were the token young person as well as token woman.
I tended to be that, yeah. Well into the second decade of my career, I tended to be the token young person.
It's unbelievable, isn't it, to think just how things have changed now and how backward they were back then.
Well, yeah. You know, very much so. And I never really thought of myself as a trailblazer. I didn't walk into rooms saying, okay, I'm holding up the world for young women and women and, you know, people in general. I didn't think in those terms. I just wanted to, to earn my way there and to compete and be worthy of it.
And get on with the job.
And I think that for me, that was the best way for me. I had a lot of women over the years ask me, okay, how are you doing it? And, you know, what lessons do you have for me and such? And, you know, I think, honestly, the secret, at least for me, was just not thinking about it. I just wanted to contribute and be smart and add value and have a point of view. And I wasn't afraid. I think a lot of people, you know, have a tendency to call me fearless. I guess, I don't know, I'm not thinking about whether I'm, you know, being fearless or not. I just wasn't afraid. I just, you know, felt I'm here for a reason, and I'm going to add value and create a sense of purpose and a cohesive story. And it's up to the client or the executive I'm talking to decide if it's smart or not. So pretty much what I tell people is be who you are. And if you want to be in the ring and you want to have a go, do it. Nothing should hold you back. And if you don't want to be in the ring and you don't want to have a go, that's okay. Because you know what? Maybe you're part of helping the person who does want to be in the ring be their best. So I tended to be a little bit more about, I believe in human potential. I believe in human greatness. What people set their sights on, they can really grab it and get it if they're focused enough and they make their own luck. But that doesn't have to be every person either. And there's a ton of, you know, support cast that goes into helping executive be effective at a company the size of an SMG, or, you know, I think of, you know, Maurice Levy running Publicis Group or any of the big holding company executives. You know, there's a cast of thousands. There's a great support team. You're only as good as the people around you.
What was it like to work for Maurice Levy?
I loved it. I thought Maurice was...
He's a formidable character.
He is, but he's an honorable man, and he's a gentleman. He's very smart. He's got a wicked sense of humor. He's got a really interesting sense of irony. What I particularly loved about working with Maurice is Maurice was really the best client guy in the room, guy or gal. He was the best client person in the room. And I always used to really love spending time with him with clients because he really prepared. He prepared for the meeting. He had ideas. He wanted to know their business. He studied their business. He really set a high standard. And then he'd be the first person sending the service report around via email about what we all had to do. So I really enjoyed working with Maurice.
So tell us what came next then.
Following SMG globally, I was asked by Maurice to take on the chief revenue officer role. I did that for almost a year, and then I decided it was time to take a step back. I had some personal challenges at home with my partner. Sometimes you just need to be home, you know, and you can't travel as much. So I took a sabbatical, and that proved to be really enormously helpful to, you know, kind of rebalancing our lives. And then you get some space and time, and you start to think, and, you know, it just seemed like the right thing to, you know, to take a step back and step down and from Publicis. And, you know, I'm always grateful for the experiences that I had there. It wasn't something I did, you know, absolutely intended to do, but it just felt right. So
it's all consuming, isn't it, when you're in a job like that?
Yeah, you don't realize it until you get space and time. You just don't. And, you know, I'm grateful for all the people and the relationships. And, you know, I'm still, you know, a huge fan of what Publicis is doing. But, you know, after 30 years of operating at the highest levels and being, you know, successful and, you know, being on the cutting edge, you don't realize all the sacrifices you make to your life. You know, and it's been nice this past year kind of being more balanced, being reconnected. I spend more time with my family, which is nice. My mom and dad are in their 80s, and so it's, you know, been really good to be able to be around more. I don't miss O'Hare, which is something when you think about the fact that I was there 2-3 times a week, you know, 48 weeks out of 52 weeks.
That United Lounge.
Many years.
I've spent many an evening in there waiting for a delayed flight.
Yeah, I know. It, you know, and, you know, I don't miss that. I mean, you know, it's nice to be able to go through the pre-check line and the concierge key and the global service. It's nice, but I don't really miss it.
So tell us about what you're doing now. What's a typical week?
Well, I spend a little bit more of half of my time as a senior advisor with Uptake.
Tell us about Uptake.
Sure. Uptake is a data and predictive analytics company. We build products and solutions in the IoT space. As industry begins the digital transformation, and it's just at the beginning of the digital transformation, it's very clear that machines can throw off signals and they can throw off data. And you need platforms and you need products to be able to measure them, monitor, predict failure, predict ways of making the machine or the plant or the wind turbine more efficient, more optimal in terms of its usage. And Uptake is a leading company. It's about 35 months old, so less than 3 years old, working in the space.
What kind of insights do they deliver ultimately?
It's really interesting and really simple one. So I'll give you one. One of our clients is Berkshire Hathaway Energy, and Berkshire operates some of the largest wind farms in the world. And one of their larger wind farms is in Northwest Iowa. And it's interesting, little known fact to know and tell is that, you know, the center part of America, kind of from North Dakota down to Texas, is actually the Saudi Arabia of wind. So a lot of wind farms are there. So Berkshire operates a large one. Our condition monitoring product detected in a wind farm of about, you know, 5,000 turbines that two, and they, you know, they work individually, but they work in unison, that two of these turbines had some anomalies. So our condition monitoring product detected the anomalies, sent out an alert. The crew looked at it, said, you know what, we should probably send a team out there to go take a look at those two turbines. Those two turbines were operating inefficiently. The crew was able to make quick fixes to them that cost about $5,000. Had those turbines been continued to let, or if they had been let to continue to run inefficiently, they would have broken down. So another week to 10 days later, those turbines to fix might have cost $250,000 or more, and it would have been a catastrophic failure being offline. So it's a simple little insight.
Quite profound and very important.
Yeah. And there's a lot of analogy to what we did in media. We would find the simplest of insights and then be able to kind of apply it in a way that would really make a big difference. And so what I really love about this space is it's just at the dawn of creation. I mean, I think the internet, industrial internet, has a good 2, maybe 3 decades of growth and, you know, real scale to it. Uptake is it's a fast-growing company, but it's a David versus a bunch of Goliaths out there. It's a challenger brand. It's young. It's agile. It's it's very adaptive. It's built off a modern core. So it reminds me a lot of some of the earliest days in media. And, you know, I'm working with one of the best founder entrepreneurs in the business, Brad Keywell. He's the founder CEO, working with a really talented group of people, learning a lot. And, you know, I feel like while it's a very different business than media, I can help them operate more efficiently because I've run big businesses. I understand how to make decisions, how to work process, how to, you know, put people together, how to communicate clearly, how to think about strategy, go to market. So it's been a thrill working with them and I'm really enjoying it.
Do you see a set of transferable skills that you can give him and also almost like a set of transferable problems that he has when he's building the business in the same way that you were, that it doesn't matter what industry you're in, if you're leading it and it's high growth, you're going to be met with the same kinds of problems?
Very much so. I think, you know, broadly, Uptake it's in the industrial internet space, but it's really ultimately in the digital transformation space. And so, you know, whether it's TV sets and mobile phones, transforming to digital, or, you know, machines and wind turbines, it's all kind of the same concept, isn't it? And it is very applicable. And mostly, and we talked about this before, mostly this really is about belief. You know, do people believe, does a big Fortune 500, Global 2000 company that's operated the same way for 100 years with plants and manufacturing and machines, do they believe they can change the way they operate with data and insight and predictive maintenance versus the way they have before? And so that's a huge challenge, and that's very similar to 10, 15 years ago when the media business was suddenly going from analog to digital. So very similar. I think secondly, it is about tech stack to activate the data. It's about unbelievable platforms that work with data science and algorithms to really squeeze insight out of data. And that's been a lot of fun to learn new things in the software world that you don't necessarily know in the media world. But it is, you know, there's a lot of commonality. I think in some ways the bridge between the media world and the industrial internet world has really been Adobe. I mean, that's a company I've sat on the board for 5 years. It's two main businesses are the digital marketing cloud business and the creative cloud business. It's a software and technology company that has been aiding in digital transformation, both from the creative user side as well as the digital marketing user side. And so as I've spent time on that board, as I've gone to Silicon Valley, you know, 6, 8, 10 times a year for the last dozen years, you know, you begin to see the power of software and the power of being able to take data and to take processing time and put it in the hands of smart people who can then make better judgments and have insight and do things with it. And, you know, Adobe's been enormously successful in doing that, not only as the individual user, but at the enterprise level with big customers. And that's been sort of the I guess, bridging the gap between my, you know, media marketing experience and what I'm doing now at Uptake.
I mean, Adobe's a huge global brand, of course. Even, you know, regular consumers, the man on the street has heard of them, mainly because of kind of PDFs and things like that. But it's something my mum would have heard of a brand, but she would have no other knowledge of just what a large-scale enterprise business they are and all of the various things that they're involved in.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Most people know them as the PDF company. And then if you dig a little deeper, it's
about 1% of what they actually do, isn't
it? Yeah, it is. I mean, don't get me wrong, PDF is enormously big business for Adobe, and it's one of their earliest businesses, and it really revolutionized digital printing. The founders of Adobe, Chuck Geschke and John Warnock, who were a little older but essentially contemporaries of Steve Jobs, And actually, Steve Jobs saw what those two guys were doing in like the first year of the company's existence in the 70s. This is when he was at Apple the first time. He saw what they were doing and he offered to, he said, I'm going to write you a check now. I want to buy your company. And they both said no. Chuck and John were like, no. And he's like, why? I'm going to make, you know, I'm going to buy your company. You'll be rich. And they were like, we don't know what it's going to be yet. We just don't know. We're not ready. And that took a lot of balls when you think about it.
Don't
you know? I mean,
I'd take the check.
The check?
I can be bought.
Right. You know, they couldn't be bought and they said no to Steve Jobs. That's
wow.
pretty cool.
That's pretty good.
But they were a bit older, but they were contemporaries of Steve. They were one of the first software companies to be founded in the Valley. Both of those guys came from Xerox, which was a true innovator at the time. And here it is, you know, 30 plus years later, and they're successful. They've transformed their business. They really now are the leader in how creativity is digitally done between Photoshop and Light Pro and many of the creative products that film producers use, creative agencies use, creators of all kinds use. And then they're the transformational leader in digital marketing, where they've built a suite of products called the Experience Cloud that help marketers manage and measure and analyze what their digital marketing efforts are giving them. You know, the transformation of the company has been amazing. And I mentioned Chuck and John, who were the founders, who are still on the board. But Shantanu Narayen, the CEO, has done a tremendous job, a world-class CEO, one of the best CEOs out there. And the performance of the company really shows. It's really one of the fastest-growing, highest-valued tech stocks out there. And it's doing it by doing it the old-fashioned way, which is smart strategy, execute the heck out of it, don't be afraid to take a risk. I mean, they transformed their business really in the last 5 years, selling boxes of software to a subscriber-based selling model with the Creative Cloud business, and then entering the digital marketing business. They were not in the digital marketing business less than 10 years ago.
And now they're huge.
And now they're huge. They're the market leader.
Do you find it hard in your new portfolio career being a board member? Because you were the actual CEO in your previous incarnations.
Yeah.
When you talk strategy, normally, you know, 10, 20 years earlier, you would have then gone away from that room and executed it. Whereas now you go away and you're going to do something else and leave it to some other person. And like you say, they're going to execute the hell out of it. Is that a personal challenge for you?
You know, being a board member, you really have to understand you are not there to operate the company. And you are not there to overly suggest or mandate to the CEO how to operate the company. You're there to ask incredibly important questions around strategy, future vision, 1, 2, 3, 5 years out. You're there to represent shareholders' interests and make sure that, you know, the foundation of the company, audit, tax, cash flow, all of security, which is an increasingly important area with all the hacks and cyber threats out there, that those are being properly planned for, executed so that, you know, within guidelines, SEC guidelines, et cetera, so that shareholder interests are protected. And you're there to help the company grow top line, grow profitable EBITDA, and grow talent. And that requires you to take a position where you are responsible to ask strategic questions and give strategic guidance, but you have to leave the operation, the tactics at the door. And at first, when I started to do more board work, that was a little awkward feeling because you're thinking, oh, I would do this strategically and here's how I would do it. And you begin to realize, no, you got to decouple it. You know, the what and the vision is different from the how. And then over time, what you begin to realize is that, you know, if you can get a bit more upstream and you can elevate your thinking and you can get more strategic, you actually start asking the kinds of questions and you start to be a partner in areas that operators and CEOs don't always have the luxury of time for. And so, you know, having a really great smart board who's complementary, who's strategic, who's watching blind spots, thinking about the things that the operating team can't think about is enormously valuable. I really like my board experiences, both Adobe and Cineverse, because the CEOs are world class. They know how to leverage and use their board, and the board is engaged. It's a strategic discussion. It's a supportive discussion. It's a challenging discussion.
But a true partnership.
But a true partnership. And I think that...
They don't see the board as an inconvenience. They see it as something that they can leverage and learn from and take advantage of all of the talent around the table.
Exactly. And I think that when you decide to join a board, you know, you think, oh, wow, it's a board. It's awesome. You know, you really have to do your homework. Is it a good company? Is it a CEO and executive team who's going to welcome collaboration, partnership, input from the board? Is it meaty strategic issues, or is it just going through the motions? Can you contribute to the company and to shareholders? And will you also learn and benefit from the experience? These are really key things that I've learned over the course of the last several years to look for, to ask for. I feel, you know, just really privileged to sit on both of those boards and work with the quality of, you know, people that I am working with. And really, at the end of the day, you know, I would recommend the experience to anybody, but you have to be thoughtful about it and you have to choose wisely.
What's next for you?
I really enjoy where I am right now. I'm enjoying my place. I mean, I'm doing some really interesting and fun work with Uptake. I'm working with a group of small clients and people as an advisor and helping them think through some of their issues strategically from a consulting standpoint. I've got balance, which I really love. You know, I think it sounds a little trite, but, you know, I truly do enjoy working with the people that I work with, and that's nice. And you know, I can take, you know, a Friday off and go up to our lake house in Michigan and hang out there, too. So I've really enjoyed, you know, kind of recrafting, rebuilding a life that, you know, still allows me to be intellectually stimulated, but allows me to be a bit more in touch with just kind of the normal pace of life. So what's next? I tend to be a little bit surprising in and of itself. I mean, I'm always looking for like the next challenge or curious about what's out there. You know, the last impression I want to leave is I'm just, you know, kind of steady state cruising at 25,000 feet and, you know, that's it. But on the other hand, I really like my place where I am in the world right now.
What advice would you give to someone starting out in their career that wants to follow a similar path?
Be curious. Take risks, especially when you're younger. The first 10 years of your career should really be about risk-taking to the ultimate degree. You are the sum of experiences, and you just don't have the opportunity to take big, big risks in your second or your third decade of a career because the stakes are higher, the positions are bigger, the people that you oversee are larger, and, you know, you can't screw around. But, you know, when you're 22, 25, 28, you can afford to have a go. So take big risks. I actually think that my international experience was hugely important to my career, successful career. When you work outside of your own country in a new and different world with different custom, culture, language, different ways of working, you really grow. You grow professionally. You grow personally. You're out there. You have your brain. You have your briefcase. You don't have the same resources. You don't have the same custom and culture to depend on. You have to adapt. And I think the earlier you can learn that, the better off you are in a career, especially in the service business. So I used to joke at the agency, like if I were 25 again, I would work in a programmatic company and I would go to China. And I still think that largely holds true because I think you have to get outside of your comfort zone in order to really know what you love, what you're passionate about, and what you're good at.
Laura, it's been hugely enjoyable. Thank you ever so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Loved it. Thank you.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.